I am 33. The 29th of April, 1986, to the 28th of April, 1987. Above. Drawing to a Close by Mark Hughes. Every time that Jenny put on the radio, nothing was going down at all. But then, on one fine morning, Jenny tunes into a New York radio station. She didn't believe what she heard at all. She is shaking to that fine, fine music, her life saved by a rock and roll. Jenny was a five-year-old Lou Reed hearing Elvis Presley's Heartbreak Hotel on his radio. I have just turned 33. I am not Jenny, but I am still in love with Elvis. When I listen to the radio in 1986, there is still nothing happening at all. It is American hip-hop and sampling which is going to save my life. Enjoying the creative collage of hip-hop music, somebody asks White Boy, "What are you doing uptown? Are you chasing our women around?" I ask for pardon, explaining that this is the furthest from my mind. I explain that I am King Boy D, and I am just looking for a dear, dear friend of mine. I explain that I am waiting for my man, and thankfully here he comes, dressed in those telltale A&R shoes and his long black fedora hat. The man from Creation Records hands me a box of early pressings of The Man. CRE LP 014. I gaze fondly at that sexy album cover shot, wondering if I will still look handsome at 70. Everything creative is increasingly being cut up. Perhaps it's all the hip-hop that I've been listening to. As I reflect on that cover photo, I'm still in love with Elvis. And for an idle moment, I become Elvis with his guitar. In a sea of contradictions, all I know for certain is that my ship is coming in. This is because I can see it on the cover photo. More seriously, the album reviews are very positive. I had left my A&R role at WEA and impatiently had to wait for The Creation Man and The Man, as in the album. I was feeling good. I was feeling oh so fine. But that would not last about 3 months until I was taken captive by another creative idea. Irritable, restless, and discontent, I asked the world why Andy Warhol is shite. 1986 was a year of letting go of a lot of stuff in my life. However, in subsequent years, the Andy Warhol question did linger. Certainly for a lot longer than 15 minutes. We welcome the new year of 1987 with everyone oblivious to the great storm and the stock market crash which are going to turn the UK upside down in the autumn. Equally, almost everyone was oblivious to our emerging plans to subvert the music industry in 1987. A journalist asks, what were the clouds like on New Year's Day 1987? Although, as Stuart McConey once wisely observed, why would a journalist ask a musician what were the clouds like? On that New Year's Day, there was a bright blue sky. It was a beautiful day. It was a new day. Shamans throughout the world love and respect the ancestors, and they are with me in my memories today. On that New Year's Day, a lyric from the future plays inside my head. Come together as one, come together as one. This anthem plays over and over in my head. Finally, the primal scream of 1986 that I had struggled to release was surfacing. I hadn't fallen out with my A&R role at WEA. I had walked away from the music industry. But there was unfinished business. I was still in love with Elvis, and Andy Warhol was still shite. However, the primal scream surfacing at the beginning of 1987 was more cathartic than angry. "Come together as one" was the lyric which was going to unlock my creative future. As the man in 1986, I'd wanted that girl. I believed in rock and roll. I was the king of joy, and I loved my Gibson ES-330. But 1987 was the time to come together as one, unified and of one accord. The Accomplice and I came together as the Justified Ancients of Mumu. King Boy D would have the companionship of the Accomplice aboard the good ship, pirating music in a hip-hop style. Nothing was forbidden. Everything was now permissible, and everything was possible. The first single arising out of our creative partnership was "All You Need Is Love." All we needed to light the fuse was hip-hop-infused love. In 1986, I turned against rock and roll historical artefacts such as the Velvet Underground. Now I turned on the record player and the 12-inch white label of "All You Need Is Love" played. I began to realise that our lives had been saved by mashed up rock and roll. Together and unified, we celebrated the Mumu, cause because together we had power. Together we had the power to sample, plagiarise, offer commentary, and most importantly, the power to cut up the musical past and reimagine the future. In our conversations, the Accomplice and I began to ask ourselves in 1987, what goes on? And we began creatively reassembling the past. The Accomplice lamented, "One minute born, 1 minute doomed. 1 minute up, 1 minute down." He fairly accurately prophesied the imminent war between the peace-loving Mumu people and the suited men from the Copyright Protection Army. I reassure him that, "You know, it will work out all right. Do what you should, and you know it will be all right." He encourages me to accept the contradictions, and I obliquely asked, "What time is love?" It is April 1987, and my 33rd year on this rapidly spinning planet is drawing to a close. My question about Andy Warhol was rhetorical. I'm still in love with Elvis, and today grudgingly acknowledge that the Velvet Underground were okay. More substantively, I feel like the Accomplice and myself are on the threshold of something. I look forward to turning 34. I'm just going to miss the magical long player symmetry of being 33 and a third.
Below, 33 and a third RPM by Tracy Moberly. Beginning my 33rd year of revolution around this planet, I was spunked out, disillusioned, done in. I was finished working for the man. It was a dark year, but I left it feeling revolutionized, in part due to a Greengate sampler and the band Brilliance guitarist The Accomplice. I liked revolutions. I liked Pete Burns' "You Spin Me Round." Rock music was over. That whole thing of the man standing centre stage, holding his cock, the electric guitar, stiff and hard at that jaunty angle. In front of him, thousands of blokes metaphorically wanking away. Rap and hip-hop from a British perspective and the Greengate sampler were the future. I started counting the beats. My contract as A&R man at Warner Electra Atlantic, WEA, was due to expire in September 86. I needed to hand in my resignation, eliminating any risk of being fired. At this very point, I didn't know if I still had a job with WEA to resign from. A week after my 33rd birthday, I was on some low-down peak of Colombia's Pico Simón Bolívar, Colombia's highest mountain range. I was unable to get any further up the mountain. I had to go back down and face the music. Here, the resignation letter started to take shape in my mind. I will be 33.3 years old in September, a time for revolution in my life. There is a mountain to climb the hard way, and I want to see the world from the top. I wasn't going to get to the top of this mountain. My inner tensing wasn't kicking in at this point. The previous week, my birthday, 29th April 1986, was spent at Her Majesty's pleasure in North Eye Prison in Sussex. I had been arrested for the shooting and attempted murder of Ian McCulloch, frontman of Echo and the Bunnymen, a band signed to Div Balfe and I on Zoo Records. Evidence was speculative, provided by the lyrics that followed on from a Julian Cope track, Bill Drummond Said, and a telephone tape-recorded version of a conversation between myself and Manchester's Factory Records co-owner, Tony Wilson. It was about life and death, and how the sudden death of a lead singer propels a band from virtual obscurity into universal stardom, which intrigued me. Ian Curtis's untimely death and newly completed Closer album had catapulted Joy Division. The tape recording had jammed, unthreaded, words were lost. It all pointed to me being guilty. McCulloch, out of it, didn't have a whodunit clue and just went along with what the press were saying. That same day, 200 miles away, Nazi sympathiser Wallace Simpson Windsor was being buried in the grounds of Frogmore. Conditions at Her Majesty's North Eye Prison were appalling, but I thought they'd be worse had Wallace made it to Queen's status. One of my visiting orders had been agreed and I was led into a screened room in handcuffs. It was my colleague Alan McGee, Creation Records, who had been taken on by WEA at the same time as me. Already sat down, under his breath, McGee tells me to listen, as he explained how he'd been given inside information that a prison system revolution was underway, which could see me walk out of prison tomorrow. He'd be waiting with a driver to take me to a safe place until new evidence came to light on my case to grant me a pardon before trial. McGee was right. Overnight riots erupted in prisons all over the UK. North Eye, I later learned, was the worst. The men revolted, setting everything alight, taking over the prison. I simply walked out of there. McGee was waiting. Car windows blackened. We were dropped at the Piccadilly line, which had just opened an extension line to Heathrow Terminal 4, so I knew I wasn't going local. This was how I came to be in Colombia with McGee, formulating my advance resignation letter, which I did hand in after new evidence turned up and charges against me dropped a month or so later. I was left a free man to get on with being 33 and a third. Sermons from my youth delivered by my father, a Scottish minister, resonated. 33 was the age when a man became a man, the last point of being young. 33 to me was all about Jesus being nailed to the cross. By the time this had happened to Jesus, he'd not written one fucking word, but whatever he said had created a cult following that led on to Christianity. Things happened fast. I wanted to write. Now I was the fucking man, not being run by the man, and I wanted my manhood in everything. I wanted to explode it onto vinyl, into being the manager, into man-made. I knew I should have taken Tony Wilson's advice when he said, "Don't sail out to that London." But if I hadn't, Pete Waterman, a magnificent mercenary of the music industry, would never have walked into my office, and I would never have sold him my soul for the instant success secret formula to pop music. Once you know a formula, you cannot unknow it. I got a good price for my soul. That's how it went on. I became the manager. In a film where I offered my services to save the world by answering any question on the music industry for £100. I also wanted to create my own solo album and asked McGee if he'd put it out. He agreed. I wrote the songs in a week and recorded it with Australian band The Triffids. Balfe was embarrassed by the album, not wanting me to put it out. As the zeitgeist unveiled itself, 2 weeks later, the Proclaimers emerged in the same musical vein, and we signed them. Just as the Peelers knocked at the door and said, "Bill Drummond, Julian Cope is dead. You shot him in the head."